So we've moved from the excuse me, from the Israelite way of expressing the ancient myths of the beginnings of the world and so on. We've moved from that to these old stories that would have been told around the campfire, as it were, and in the sacred sites of the various tribal groups. Most of the Abraham material is about the south, Beersheba and Hebron, so it looks like that comes from the Judah, old stories. And what we're not looking for history. I'm wondering whether there might be some kind of a parallel for us with the King Arthur and the Round Table, the Knights of the Round Table kind of thing. We're looking for the returned exiles, the leaders of the returned exiles, both priestly and then the elders of the land, thought these stories were important enough to bring together. Some of them had come down from Samaria when it was destroyed in 721, but they'd come into the Jerusalem, and now they're kind of putting them all together, so they must have still held an important element of meaning for them, for who they were and what God's design for them was. So we've just started, and we had Abraham, and we heard the promise of a family that would be like the stars of the sky, and the promise of land, and then miraculously there's a birth from the slave girl Hagar, and it's Ishmael. So he has a son now through whom perhaps the promise could continue. But we're to see that it didn't come through him, it came through someone else called Isaac, and that's what we're looking at, some of the stories now. And as we read the stories, we're not looking for accurate history. We're looking for stories that pick up essential elements of the people's self-understanding. Abraham is at Mamre, chapter 18 of Genesis. Yahweh appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre as he sat at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. He looked up and saw three men. Now this is complicated. Men, angels, they're messengers anyhow. He saw three men. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent entrance to meet them and bowed down to the ground. And he said, "My Lord, if I find favor with you, do not pass by your servant." Beautiful Eastern hospitality. "Let a little water be brought, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree. Let me bring a little bread, that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on, since you've come to your servant, Abram." So they said, "Do as you've said." And Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Make ready quickly three measures of choice flour, knead it, and make cakes." Abram ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to his servant, who hastened to prepare it. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate. So a lovely scene of hospitality. They said to him, "Where's your wife Sarah?" And he said, "There in the tent." Then one said, "I will surely return to you in due season, and your wife Sarah shall have a son." Sarah was listening at the tent entrance behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. So Sarah laughed. Again, we have laughter. The word Isaac means laughter. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I've grown old and my husband is old, shall I have pleasure?" And Yahweh said to Abram, So we've got Yahweh present, we've got three messengers. Yahweh said to Abram, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm old? Is anything too wonderful for Yahweh?' At the set time, I will return to you in due season, and Sarah shall have a son." But Sarah denied, saying, "I didn't laugh," for she was afraid. He said, "Oh yes, you did laugh." Then the men set out from there, and they looked towards Sodom. And Abram went with them to set them on their way. There's an image of it from Gustav. You've got one in this chapel here, the Chapel of the Trinity. That's what that's recalling. Yahweh said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Seeing that Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed by him? No, for I've chosen him, that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of Yahweh, by doing righteousness and justice, so that Yahweh may bring about for Abraham what he's promised him." Then Yahweh said, "How great is the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah, and how very grave their sin. I must go down and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. If not, I will know." So the messengers have gone on. Two of them have anyhow. Yahweh is obviously involved in all this, a messenger from God. And then now we're hearing about the trouble down in Sodom, which is where Lot went when they divided up the country. This is a lovely story that you know so well, but it's kind of very, it's a beautiful story, but in it is a marvellous truth. So the men turned from there and went towards Sodom, while Abraham remained standing before Yahweh. Then Abraham came near and said, "Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not forgive it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous along with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just?" And Yahweh said, "Well, if I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I'll forgive the whole place for their sake." Abram answered, "Well, let me take it upon myself to speak to the Lord, I who am but dust and ashes. Look, suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Will you destroy the whole city for the lack of 5? And Yahweh said, "All right, I won't destroy it if I find 45 there." And again, Abram spoke, Well, what about if there's 40? And he answered, "For the sake of 40, I will not do it." Then Abram said, "Oh, don't let the Lord be angry if I speak. Suppose 30 were found there." "I will not do it if I find 30 there. Let me take it upon myself," says Abraham, "to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there." And he said, "Well, for the sake of 20, I will not destroy it." Then Abraham said, "Oh, don't let the Lord be angry if I speak just once more. Suppose 10 are found there." And Yahweh replied, "For the sake of 10, I will not destroy it." Yahweh went his way when he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. I'm sure that doesn't need any explanation. It's a lovely story about intercession and somehow trusting that God won't punish the good with the evil. That remains a problem for them all the way through, excuse me, with the destruction of Jerusalem, etc. Because they had this idea, which we can easily pick up if we read the Bible without some kind of study, they had this kind of assumption, that's what it is, without questioning, that God controls everything. So if Sodom is destroyed, and of course it was destroyed by cataclysmic seismic activities well before history began, so there was some story about that, so now they're putting it in, God must have done it if it happened. If Jerusalem is destroyed, well, God must have willed it. Well, how could God will it if there are good people there? So this remains a problem all the way through because of their basic unquestioned assumption that God actually is the one organizing things rather than God is the one loving. And we're doing the organising. And if we listened, it would be beautiful. If we don't listen, dreadful things will happen, but not because God wills them. We even went so far, as you'd remember from earlier years, we even went so far, and you still hear it, unfortunately, in some places, to think that the crucifixion of Jesus was part of God's plan. So God had to be, if it happened, God must have allowed it or willed it or somehow been organising it. And that's appalling because the crucifixion of Jesus, which is an extreme form of what we're dealing with here, was of course a sin, a grave sin of injustice. And the people responsible were not God, for heaven's sake. It was the Judas a bit, but Pilate and the high priest and crowd, the fickle crowd that organised the crucifixion of Jesus. If we want to know where God is there, we have to look at Jesus and see his giving his life. Not being murdered, but giving his life, loving to the end. So here you are with this problem of a story that somehow is talking about the importance of intercession, but also God's unwillingness to punish if he can't, if he can at all avoid it. Here's a similar feeling from the ancient prophecy of Hosea, chapter 11. "How can I give you up, Ephraim?" This is the northern kingdom before the Assyrians came in and obliterated it. And the prophet at the time, Hosea, "How can I give you up," this is God, "Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Adma? How can I treat you like Zeboim? Adma and Zeboim, we don't know them so much because Sodom and Gomorrah are the two that capture the imagination. But they're two little cities in the same area. So it's talking about what we're talking about. My heart, says God, recoils within me. Brackets. If I could find five just people there, I wouldn't do it. My compassion grows warm and tender. I won't execute my fierce anger. I'll not again destroy Ephraim. For I am God. I'm not a mortal human being. I'm the Holy One in your midst. And I will not come in wrath, anger. An underlying sense of God's beauty and goodness, which they're, of course, struggling with because of this wrong assumption they have about the way the world is and thinking of God as controlling it. Then comes the story, I won't read it to you, it's too ugly to read, to be quite honest, the story of Sodom. Lot, this is just the gist of it, welcomes these two messages, two of the three that were back at Mamre. They come. Lot welcomes them. A mob in Sodom gather around the house and they want these men. They're going to abuse them sexually and every other way. So they're saying to Lot, come on, send these people out to us and we'll abuse them. The dreadful bit of the story is Lot says, oh no, you can't because they're guests and they're in my house and they come here and you can't do this. This is in lack of hospitality, to say the least. And then Lot says, but I've got two virgin daughters. You can have them if you leave the men alone. So what are we dealing with? I don't know, to be quite honest. But that's the story. But you can see the danger of all this material. Anyhow, that's what happens. So the two men, inverted commas, they're going to burn and they're going to grab Lot. So they grab Lot and pull him in and lock the door and tell Lot to get away and take his sons and their wives away. So he does. He escapes to Zoar. And the text reads, Yahweh rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from Yahweh out of heaven. So if you're still looking for facts, would you please be gentle with yourself and let the story overwhelm. God doesn't have fire and brimstone up in heaven to pour down. Something happened to Sodom, all right? Historically, but they didn't know anything about it. It was way before history begins. It was clearly destroyed, but not by God. And then, you know, the story, on their way, Lot's wife looks back. You're not allowed to look back. Even when you leave here, some people say, when I go back home, I'll be different. You know, I'll have made a few resolutions or found a kind of prayer. I think it's a pretty good idea, if I may suggest it, is you never go back home. You go forward home. Because you can't go back. The back is the past. But with new insight and new love and new silence and new prayer, we might be going back into a situation which looks like it was when we left a week ago. But in fact, it's very different because you're different. So you go forward into it. Well, anyhow, that's a bit behind this. Lot's wife looks back and turns into a pillar of salt. So there obviously was in the vicinity this salt pillar thing, and so they add a story to it. So they can show the kids, look at that, look what happened when she looked back. Now don't you look back. And then they listen to the story because it's really quite, it's there. Then we hear about, and this is quite, I don't know what to make of this either. This is the origin of the Moabites and the Ammonites. Well, just for the record, so you can see where we are. And that's Judah. That's Jerusalem. That's Judah. There's Ammon, and there's Moab. So these are the two tribal areas to the east. And this is how they came into being, according to this group. I think they would have had another story, really. Lot's two daughters get him drunk, get Dad drunk, and lie with him. Because, well, that's what you do, apparently. Now, the firstborn bore a son and named him Moab. So Moab is born from an incestual relationship between Lot and one of his daughters. I don't think the Moabites would have liked that story. He's the ancestor, says that these people, of the Moabites to this day. The younger also bore a son and named him Ben-Ammi. He's the ancestor of the Ammonites to this day. You got that clear? So we're dealing with historical, they've gone back, traced back through the ancestry and found out this is where they, all their origins were. Clearly, it's a story, and not a very nice story, but it's a story that suited Judah. Now comes another story. A story paralleling what happened in Egypt. We did this yesterday. Abram passes his wife Sarah off as his sister. He's done that before, and it worked. So he's doing it again in this story. And King Abimelech of Gerar takes Sarah, whom Abraham had said was his sister, but he didn't touch her. And on God's orders, he returns her safely to Abraham. So God is organizing everything to keep the line pure, the line that will end up being Judah. Then comes the birth of Isaac. And the text, chapter 21, reads, Yahweh dealt with Sarah as he'd said, and Yahweh did for Sarah as he promised. Sarah conceived and bore Abram a son in his old age, at the time of which God had spoken to him. The purpose of all this is to say that this is not just nature working, this is divine. We get it, of course, that the climax of this kind of way of thinking emerges in the Gospel of Luke, in a prologue, where a virgin conceives because of the power of God. So they're all trying to make sure we realize that we're looking for what God is doing in the world here, not just what happens to happen. There's a providence and a direction and some kind of misunderstanding, but understanding all mixed up. Abram gave the name Isaac to his son, whom Sarah bore him, and Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old. And that's the text that's been happening ever since within the Jewish community. Abram was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Now Sarah said, God has brought laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And she said, who would ever have said to Abram that Sarah would nurse children? But I have borne him a son in his old age. In the New Testament, the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 11, reads, by faith he, that's Abram, received power of procreation even though he was too old. The story is still alive in the New Testament period. And Sarah herself was barren because he considered him faithful who had promised. Abram trusted God's fidelity. Therefore, from one person, and this one as good as dead, descendants were born, as many as the stars of heaven and as the innumerable grains of sand by the shore. Psalm 126 picks this up. When God restored the fortunes of Zion, it seemed like a dream. Then was our mouth filled with laughter. On our lips there were songs. This is the song of the returning exiles. It was said among the nations, what marvels God worked for them. Indeed, God has done great things for us. We celebrate with joy. The birth of Isaac is a prime example of that. Now comes a very tender part of the story. The dismissal of Hagar and Ishmael. Already, we did yesterday, Sarah is envious of the maid, Hagar, who's able to bear children and she's not. So she got her banished, and Abram did what his wife demanded, and then God sent her back, and she came back. Now, this is Isaac. The child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, playing with her son Isaac. So he's 13 or 14 and he's a baby. So she said to Abraham, cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not inherit along with my son Isaac. All the way through this story, if you get a chance to read it without me interrupting it all the time, you're going to see the author's, the sympathy is with Hagar. Sarah doesn't come out of this very well at all. All our sympathy goes to this Hagar. Well, you see what happens when I read a bit more. The matter was very distressing to Abraham on account of his son, but God said to Abraham, don't be distressed because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you. For it's through Isaac that offspring shall be named for you. As for the son of the slave woman, I will make a nation of him also, because he is your offspring. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water, gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder along with the child, and sent her away. And she departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba, the place of the seven wells, right to the south of Judah. When the water in the skin had gone, she cast the child under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him, a good way off, about the distance of a bowshot, for she said, do not let me look on the death of the child. And as she sat opposite him, this is beautiful, she lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of the Lord called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Do not be afraid, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Come, lift up the boy, hold him fast with your hand, for I will make a great nation of him. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. She went, filled the skin with water, and gave the boy a drink. God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother got a wife for him from the land of Egypt. So this is the origin of Egypt and Arabia and so on. And of course, Islam, centuries later, looks back on all this as the divine blessing for them. There's a drawing of what I've just made to you. So a comment. As the story unfolds, our sympathy is with Hagar, not Sarah. While God has chosen Isaac for a special purpose, yes, God's love of Ishmael is clear, as is Abraham's. What we have in this narrative is a subversion of myth. We're not dealing with fate. Nature, the way things are, doesn't have to have the last word. God chooses those who are not able of themselves to carry out the mission entrusted to them. It's the younger son who's going to carry on the mission, and that's God's desire, as they see it. That's followed by a covenant between Abraham and Abimelech at Gerar. Then comes one of the most important chapters of the book of Genesis. God tested Abraham. Chapter 22. He said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. And Yahweh said, Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah. And in the later understanding, Moriah is Mount Zion, Jerusalem. They link that up. Offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall show you. A comment before we go on. Child sacrifice was not unknown in Israel. You find examples of it in the book of Kings and Jeremiah. As is in the surrounding cultures. Again, the book of Kings is giving evidence of that. It's important to remember that the writers and the readers of this story knew that child sacrifice was absolutely forbidden by God. And you can find that in the book of Leviticus. So what are they having God commanding child sacrifice for when they knew, and if you want to look up Leviticus chapter 18, you'll see it, they already knew that God forbade it. So we're not meant to think that God is actually giving this command. They knew, therefore, that God couldn't command such a thing. Abram lived before the Mosaic law, however, and so could not be portrayed as thinking that God was asking such an obedience of him. To jump ahead, the aim of the story is to make it very clear to people who are telling this story in their catechetics, etc., to their children and so on, that we don't kill people, our firstborn. All the other tribes, Moab does, Ammon does, it's a common enough practice, but we don't do it. And that's what this story will say abundantly clearly. Not only is God not commanding it, Abram thinks God's commanding it in the story because everyone else is doing it, but God will make it perfectly clear, no, I don't want that, and never did want it, and it won't happen. Let's look at the text. Abram rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of the young men with him and his son Isaac. So beautifully, Abram, though he has misunderstood God, is willing to do whatever God wants. It's an extraordinary story. God has promised a line, the stars of heaven. The only one through whom the promise is going to come is Isaac. And here, God seems to be asking Abraham to give Isaac up. Which is, that applies to all of our lives. The things that are most precious to us, maybe we need that God. We need to give them, we need to put God, seek first the kingdom of God. Not anything else that we say is quite essential to our life. So let's read it. Abram got up early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and set out and went to the place in the distance that God had shown him. On the third day, we're going to meet that a lot in the Bible, the third day is always the day of revelation. Exodus 19 chapter is the best chapter to read on this, when God says, I'm going to come down on Mount Sinai, and he talks about what's going to happen on the third day. On that's happened about four or five times in as many verses. On the third day. That becomes, it's nothing to do with two or four, it becomes a memory in their tradition, because on the third day is always the day when God reveals truly who God really is. So, on the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place far away. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship and then come back to you. Abram took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. And Isaac said to his father, Abram, Father, and he said, I'm here, my son. The fire and the wood are here, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abram said, God will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them went off together. When they came to the place that God had shown him, Abram built an altar there and laid the wood in order. He bound his son Isaac, laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abram reached out his hand and took the knife to kill his son. But, this is the whole point of the story, the angel of Yahweh called to him from heaven and said, Abram, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abram looked up and saw a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. And Abram went, took the ram, and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, on the mountain of Yahweh it shall be provided. So I hope I haven't mucked that story up for you. It's worth looking at again quietly. The point of it is that, well, I think part of the point of it is, those, I might think I know what God wants me to do, and I can see the essential steps in that. And if I want to do God's will, which is what we all want to do at best, I can think that these steps that I think God is revealing to me are essential. And the story is saying to me, no, wait it. Be careful. Don't lock God in anywhere. Wait. It's about discernment. It's about all of that. And it's about being ready to give up. I often thought, well, pardon me, I'll finish the sentence. I often think like this about the priesthood. For me, for example, I've been 58, is it? 57 years a priest now. And I like it. It's my life and I can do it. So that's a blessing. But truly, I have to be ready to give it up tomorrow if God calls me to. So you know that. So each day is a new day. Each day has to, resolution has to be renewed, and all the time watching to see. And it's the same with everyone in your walk of life. We have to want God's will. And even though something looks as it did to Abraham, his son Isaac is essential to the whole thing. How can he do God's will without Isaac? But he has to be ready to give Isaac up. Of course, God doesn't want him to give Isaac up, which becomes perfectly clear. But the readiness is there. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, says Yahweh, because you have done this, because you have not withheld your son, your only son," and that only son comes into the New Testament a number of times in regard to God and Jesus. Willing, God's willingness, inverted commas, to give his son, even to risk his son and risk us abusing and murdering him. God, out of love, takes that risk. Sadly, we did crucify, or he was crucified. "Because you've done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will indeed bless you, and I'll make your offspring as numerous as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of their enemies, and by your offspring shall all the nations of the earth gain blessing for themselves, because you have obeyed my voice." You've listened and you've been willing to give everything up, but I don't want you to give it up. I want you to be willing to, but I don't want you to do it. So stay your hand and the promise will be fulfilled. The text goes on, and Abram settles at Beersheba, right to the south of Judah. Abram's brother's descendants are given, and they include Bethuel, the father of Rebekah. So she'll come back into the story. She's going to become Isaac's wife. So they give their genealogy of Syria, what's happening up there. Then we have the first part of the promised land purchased by Abraham, and it's an area for the tomb of the patriarchs. That's why it's so important now still to all the major religions in that world, near Hebron. Sarah lived 127 years. This was the length of Sarah's life. Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abram went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Then he purchases the land from the Hittite, and then Abram buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, facing Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. The field and the cave that is in it passed from the Hittites into Abram's possession as a burial place. So the beginnings of the promise unfolding. Then comes the story of the marriage of Isaac. After Sarah's death and burial, comment, Abram sends his servant off to the area around Haran. He doesn't want his son to marry one of the locals. He wants to go back and keep the line pure. So he, from which he came to find a wife for Isaac from his own kin. And he returns with Rebekah, the brother of Laban, and the granddaughter of Abraham's brother, Nahor. Isaac, we're told, had come from, this is important, Beer Lahai Roy was the name given, if you remember, Hagar, that was the well of Hagar. Beer Lahai, the well of life and of seeing. So Isaac is coming from there. There's got to be a connection here with Hagar, an unexpected connection. After Abraham's death, Isaac returns to Be'er Lahai Roy. I missed this for years, because it's so easy to miss if you... But thanks, that's the advantage of study. You can be alerted to things by the scholars. In Genesis 16, Be'er Lahai-Roi is associated with Hagar. Is there a hint here that Sarah's death has opened up an opportunity for reconciliation with Hagar? This suspicion is reinforced by the fact that Ishmael and Isaac stand together at their father's burial. So they're both there standing when they bury Isaac. Isaac meets Rebekah and she became his wife, and he loved her. It's a festival. Then comes a very extraordinary little passage. Chapter 25 of the book of Genesis. Abram took another wife whose name was Keturah. I often used to wonder why on earth this is mentioned here. What's it got to do with anything? Well, I think it's got a lot to do with it. Abram took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him, and there's a list of names there which you can pronounce if you can. And the sons of Dedan were, and there's a list of them, the sons of Midian were Ephah, Ephah, etc., etc. All these were the children of Keturah. Indeed, Abram is being presented here as the father of many nations. It's interesting that an early rabbinic suggestion is that Keturah is actually Hagar. Called Keturah here because, and they say, her acts were as fragrant as incense. Keturet is the Hebrew for incense. And there's the reference if you want to look it up. For the rabbis, they're trying to do what I'm trying to do and we're trying to do, get to understand the complexities of the text. And they're suggesting, no one can say it's true, but they're suggesting that this is actually Hagar, called as a love name Keturah, because she's like the incense of the smell of the incense. So we might have here a complete reconciliation with Hagar. Then comes the death of Abraham. Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, an old man and full of years, and he was gathered to his people. His sons Isaac and Ishmael, here it is again in Genesis 25, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, where they buried his wife, east of Mamre. After the death of Abram, God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac settled at Be'er Lahai-Roi, probably with his mother, Hagar, and his brother, Ishmael. Then we're given all the descendants of Ishmael, and by way of conclusion, the birth of Isaac doesn't displace Ishmael in the view of these very subtle, broad-minded authors. God may choose, and he has chosen Isaac, as they see it, but God doesn't reject. Brothers can live together in peace. And we're going to see an extraordinary example of that in the following presentation. I had a feeling you liked this the other day, so I'm going to play again for you. There is a place. So there's a place, Be'er Lahai-Roi. There's a place for everyone. There's a place for Hagar. That even though there was this not good relationship with Sarah, Sarah's died now, and maybe there's been a beautiful reconciliation here again. Tribal reconciliation. They're trying to hold out this stuff of peace. So let's try